Hey, welcome back, everybody. I am here today with the good Dr. John Osborne and J.D. Enright.
Hey.
Here at Dallas, Texas. They've allowed me to kind of come hang out with them for the day. So, and I should start with, they run Clear Cardio here, and Clearly is something that we use in our practice, the CT angiogram with the AI evaluation, which is just very, it's the future of cardiovascular screening, really. So whenever I reached out to Clearly and I wanted to get a cardiologist that was not on their payroll, that I could really get the straight straight story, they gave me his name right off the bat and reached out to him, and he was very gracious with his time. And Dr. John Osborne is trained at you did your residency down at Brigham and Women's.
Yeah, Brigham and Women's Hospital now. Yeah. So Mass General and the Brigham are all now one part of the same organization. So now the latest name is called Mass General Brigham, or MGB. Okay. Not MGA. This is an MGB, which is the smaller of the two, as I recall. But if you're into English sports cars. But yeah, so it's Mass General Brigham is where I did my training in internal medicine, cardiology. Got my, also I was in the MD PhD program prior to that, so I picked up a PhD, which, you know what BS is, right? Yeah, yeah, right.
Bachelor
MD is
science.
More dung.
Oh.
And PhD is piled
deeper. Higher and deeper.
Yeah, so
yes.
I've got all that squared away.
All this doctor humor is
killing me. Yes. A lot of slapstick.
So anyway, but yeah, so I did all my training in Northeast, and then rationality overcame me and moved to Texas. Been here 28 years. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
Straight out of residency, came right here.
But fellowship, yeah.
Or fellowship,
yeah, yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, so I did my 7 years at the Brigham and did my training there, and then came down to Texas and it never looked back. You know, one thing I get to say, and you appreciate this too, I love telling people, particularly the Northeasterners, whom I love, right?
I'm from Boston, so yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. So I love saying, the one great thing about Texas is never once have I had to shovel heat off my driveway. So there you go.
Just hail.
There's that.
Just hail. Yeah. I've seen that.
Yeah. Off your roof, maybe. But,
yeah, yeah.
You
know,
but
exactly.
Anyway, but yeah.
You're
so I've been here.
Also a lipidologist as well.
Yeah, I was
saying. So my journey was, you know, I trained in general cardiology. One of the other little notable things about my training is, again, this is just pure luck, that in the Department of Genetics at Harvard is an amazing lab. And back in the 90s, we were doing what's called positional cloning, which is now a legacy technology after we cloned the human genome. But we were doing positional cloning, which is unbelievably tedious to do, and I won't bore the details. But this lab was the lab that came up with, identified all of the genes that caused hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is a fairly common genetic form of inherited heart disease. And then also we did a lot of dilated cardiomyopathies as well, doing all the genetics behind that. So I spent 2 years in my time at Boston in the Department of Genetics at HMS doing that positional cloning, which was really great. So I went from a physiologist, that was my PhD, into a molecular geneticist. And so that was kind of my evolution. And then as a cardiologist, I was always interested in the non-invasive stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Echoes and nuclear cardiology and stress tests and vascular and ultrasound and all those kind of tools. And really wasn't terribly interested on the interventional side, like doing stents. A lot of my colleagues were, but I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the Brigham back then is we'd get people from all over the place, right, coming to get their caths at the Brigham. And we'd cath them, and we'd see some, you know, we'd call it lumpy bumpy stuff, right? No blockages, but, you know, it was completely normal.
Right.
And we'd say, lumpy bumpy, not necessarily to them. We'd say, oh, you're good. There's no blockages. Oh, that's good. And then fare thee well. Uh-huh. And I'm going, but wait a minute, isn't that kind of like saying you got a polyp and we're trying to diagnose early, you know, colon cancer or things that lead to colon cancer? And I thought, that's kind of a little bit wrong. We just say you're fine, right? Mm-hmm. Go off, marinate for a while, and maybe if you're lucky, you come back and we balloon you or stent you or bypass you. And I thought, that's weird. So that was kind of my genesis of preventative cardiology, going, wait a minute, we're seeing stuff that's important and actionable. Although, as it turns out, even on a heart cath, we're really seeing late disease, right? Because disease always starts in the donut, right? If you got a donut, right, it starts in the donut, not mm-hmm. the hole,
right?
And the plaque will grow outwards, mm-hmm. literally for could be decades, right? Mm-hmm. And you could have a normal heart cath, or even maybe a little lumpy bumpy, and you could still have a considerable amount of plaque that could rupture and kill you. And so there was no such thing as preventive cardiologists back then. This is the mid-90s. And so I basically, and almost without thinking, I'm going, you know, I really need to understand all of these things on the imaging side. How can we detect it early? And then on the therapeutic side, once we do detect it, what to do about it? So along the way, in no particular, in retrospect, yes, perhaps I had a plan, but no particular way, you know, got my internal medicine cardiology, and then I got boarded in nuclear cardiology, boarded in echocardiography, boarded in later cardiac CT when the first those machines came out in the early 2000s, got boarded in hypertension, got boarded in lipids. So I kind of put together all the big parts of preventive cardiology because there was no training program. So I just kind of put together my own training program and got 7 boards out of the whole thing. So very expensive wallpaper, I like to say.
Yeah.
But that I've seen it.
Yeah.
I actually put it all in new frames and everything. So
exactly.
To match the decor in the clinic.
Right. So
that was cheap.
So that was my journey. And then, you know, in the last maybe 10 or 15 years, we've now come up with this concept of, quote, preventative cardiology, which is really twofold. One, early detection, not late detection, mm-hmm. which is historically what we waited for, mm-hmm. as you know, working all those years in the emergency room.
Yeah.
And that's really done with cardiac CT. I mean, that is the tool, right? I don't do stress tests anymore. They're not accurate. They're insensitive. Any blockage less than 70%, they'll be normal. 25 to 40% false negative rate, where there is a severe blockage mm-hmm. and it misses it. Mm-hmm. 25 to 40% false positive rate, which then gets everybody riled and excited, and patients and docs, and we'd cart them off to the cath lab, spend another $20,000 cathing them, putting catheters, you know, via the groin, now yeah. go through the wrist, yeah. into their heart, only to find out you're fine. But again, you can still have plaque mm-hmm. that I can't see in a heart cath. So cardiac CT is really the dominant strategy to be able to assess the status of your coronary arteries, if you have plaque or blockages. And then the big, big excitement in the last few years, as you know, is now adding AI yeah. on top of that data, which allows me to see literally stuff that I could not see before.
Yeah.
And you know, how AI works, we take that incredible massive gigabytes worth of data set, the raw data, the 3D high-resolution data coming out of the CT machine. We then send it up the cloud, process it using Clearly, which will do a couple things. One, it will look at every single one of the millions of pixels that make up that high resolution three-dimensional mm-hmm. data set. Mm-hmm. It will then, on top of that, when we look at what we call grayscale, so imagine a chest x-ray or an x-ray or CAT scan or MRI, those are all grayscales, right? It's black to white, gray in the middle.
Right.
Our eyes can see or delineate about 50 shades of gray.
Like the movie.
Like the mm-hmm. movie, exactly, mm-hmm. right? I know where your head is.
Yeah. Well, JD. You know, why did they call it that? Well, there's got to be a reason. Now we know.
Exactly.
Because the eye can see 50 shades of gray.
You're learning new stuff.
Who'd have thought?
Exactly,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
It's worth tune the trip
in.
Already.
Tune in.
It is,
yeah.
right?
50 shades of gray. Trivia Central. So our eyes can see 50 shades of gray, right? However, every one of the millions of pixels coming out of the CT machine is electronically encoded, with over 2,000 shades of gray.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine mm-hmm. our eyes could see not just red, green, and blue, but infrared, mm-hmm. ultraviolet, x-rays, microwaves, gamma rays, right? The entire yeah. electromagnetic spectrum we can now see with the AI.
I would see that movie.
Yeah.
2,000 shades of gray?
2,000 shades of gray.
The next
Boy, I can
generation.
Only imagine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whoa.
Life after 50 shades.
I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah, that would be great.
And then, lastly, it will then give us, so seeing what cannot be seen with our eyes, and then quantify that.
Yeah.
Down to a tenth of a cubic millimeter, which is an infinitesimal volume.
Yeah.
So it really is just remarkable. And it's the cool thing is, It's so accessible, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, you can order Clearly.
Yeah.
You can order
the
Clearly.
Nice thing, yeah, with the AI piece, it almost brings guys like me who isn't, you know, I prior to that, I wouldn't feel comfortable really reading one.
Right.
And I can get that information, and it quantifies the disease.
You only have to do about
10,000,
then you get good.
Yeah. But yeah, it's phenomenal
information.
It's really
the democratization of imaging.
Yeah.
Right? That you can,
yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Lots of complicated things happen from, you know, the data and the AI and all that.
Yeah.
But it really now becomes accessible to a lot more people. And also, I think, understandable to our patients, too.
Yeah, yeah. And it does, you know, and you've talked about this on your podcast like crazy, but that soft plaque versus hard plaque and, you know, calcified plaque, which doesn't matter so much, and then the soft plaque, which is what... And then it delineates that even further into low-density soft plaque, which has been... I mean, we found some stuff on our patients that were really moving in a different direction that would, I feel, drastically changing their outcomes 5 to 10 years based on this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're saving their lives.
Yeah, you're getting cheesy, but yeah, pretty
much. No, you are.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah,
it
is life-saving.
It's okay to be cheesy.
So a little kernel truth here, but JD and I have kidded about having, you know, on those construction sites, no accidents for 370 days or something. You know, we need to have the life saved.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's a little cheesy, but...
Right.
You know, it's,
but it is. I mean, that's what we're doing. But, you know, I was looking at... You wonder why it's not part of the vernacular, part of what we're doing, like, you know, colonoscopies and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I was looking at, I mean, this might be sketchy, and I may want to edit this out, I imagine.
But tune in.
Hospitals make, you know, I was looking at what specialties make the hospitals the most money.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what it is?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's cardiovascular. There's no incentive. Why? I mean...
Why would you? I mean, if you're not an MD.
I love this controversial stuff. Let's keep this
going. But if you're not an MD or DO, but you're a CFO, you're going, hey, everybody, don't change a thing.
Doing good.
We're
going to buy a new cardiology wing.
Right? You're giving free coupons for a month's worth of like fast food to all of your patients.
Yeah.
Here's all the fat food you can eat. Just come on in because we'll see you in about 3 months.
Oh, yeah. It's terrible.
Yeah.
Even now. I mean, they try, but it's still a bunch of carby stuff. Even in the doctor's lounge, there's still a soda machine where I have privileges.
So... 20 years ago, well, no, 25 years ago, you have to do this 200 hours of training in radiation, right, to get your license here in Texas. So I did all that. It was down at St. Luke's in Houston, right?
Yeah.
So as it turns out, St. Luke's, which is a notable place for cardiology and for bypass surgery, the home of DeBakey and Cooley and those guys, right?
Yeah.
I have no idea who those people are, by the way.
In the basement of St. Luke's. Was actually the most profitable McDonald's.
Oh my gosh.
Per square foot.
Yeah.
That was it. The most profitable McDonald's. Yeah. And I remember going down there and, you know, there weren't many places to eat, so food desert, right? Mm-hmm. So I go down there and try to find something to eat. But I remember seeing on the menu, and this is incredible, you know, they had French fries. They had small, medium, large. Then they had maybe extra large. Then they had something beyond that, only in Texas. They had... The bucket. It literally was.
A bucket of what?
A bucket.
Fries.
Of fries.
A French fried potatoes.
A bucket of fries.
Really?
I mean, like this big, which is, well, anyway, it was a bucket.
Wow.
Right?
Only
sitting
in Texas.
At St. Luke's in the basement, in the most profitable, busiest McDonald's, you could buy a bucket of fries.
Wow.
Which, again, is perfect. Mm-hmm. Create the problem, fix the problem.
Yeah.
Right?
Fair enough.
I mean, isn't that insane?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
that's like being a diabetes a doctor and owning Willy Wonka's chocolate factory.
Exactly.
Like, why not?
Yeah. Might as well make,
in one door,
make,
out
make
the other.
make money on both ends.
Yes,
right?
I mean. Exactly.
Whew.
Yeah. Yeah. So whenever I reached out to you the first time, I remember we were talking and I was listening to everything you're doing. And I thought, you're a rare bird. You're not the average.
Well,
I mean, I'm just thinking the way you guys make money is doing interventions.
I
say all that to. I mean, I love my cardiologist friends,
absolutely.
And they're doing
a
great job. And I appreciate everything they do.
When people didn't detect the disease early.
Yeah. It's just it's just something that needs to be layered on to the whole picture. But
right. And I kid about putting my interventional colleagues and surgeons out of business. And, you know, but in reality, I mean, it is a team. It just, unfortunately, we have not spent enough time, effort, thought on, well, wait a minute, that person that had that heart attack, what's been going on with them the prior 20 to 30 years? Because we know the disease is there and it's detectable.
Yeah.
So I think we're just adding on to the pie. Now, I think down the road there may be some shifts, and I think there may be some of my interventional colleagues that see the light of prevention and go, wait a minute, I'm a recovering interventional cardiologist, and now I'm interested in how do we detect it early and prevent it so we don't need to put people through mechanical procedures.
So you guys are the two doctors here. I'm curious, is there data going back to like the 1700s or 1800s? You know, I know there wasn't great medicine back then, but that shows people having heart attacks and strokes. Or did they even know what those were back then? Or just they died? Just died.
So that's a great question, right? Yeah. The first medical case history, the first medical description of angina, right? Angina.
What is angina, by the way?
So angina basically is when your pipes are too small to supply enough blood flow to the heart muscle.
When you say your pipes,
your arteries.
Your arteries, right. Okay. Your arteries are too small.
So it's kind of like an engine, right? Yeah. So you apply a load, exercise, running, mowing the lawn, doing physical activity. You apply the load, right? The engine needs more fuel, blood. And when there's a discrepancy, when the load is hot, too high, and the pipes aren't big enough,
you're starving the engine.
Yeah, and you start getting typically, now again, the problem is, and as an ER doc, you know, I mean, there's all these different manifestations of what we call ischemia. That is an imbalance between the load and
the demand.
And the demand, right? But classically, typically, it's heaviness, tightness, pressure, ache, burning, that kind of thing. May or may not radiate to the neck, jaws, back, shoulders. Could have nausea, shortness of breath, sweating. I've said this a few times. Unfortunately, it can also just manifest as nothing. It can manifest as fatigue. It can manifest as just shortness of breath.
Got it.
Flu-like symptoms, throwing up,
sounds
nausea.
Like everything can be a symptom of angina. That's the problem,
right?
That's the problem. Like, my God, I probably had six heart attacks on the way here today.
Exactly.
I mean, I had sweating.
And survived every one of them.
I ate some terrible food. I felt nauseous. I was like, oh, my God.
Right.
So I must have angina.
That's really the medical crux of the problem is it can show up in any number of different ways. Right? Yeah. Anyway, but that's angina.
So you got to, okay.
Angina
got it.
And angina.
That. Appreciate it.
So that diagnosis of angina, right, which is a late stage of the disease, was really what is how the entire cardiology
back in the old
medical
days.
Industrial complex is built on. It's finding the blockage, right? And then if you find the blockage, you fix the blockage.
But
well,
in the 1700s and 1800s,
so the first description of angina, right, is 1812.
Wow.
Really?
So relatively recent.
The War of 1812. I got it.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So part of that was, right, people never lived long enough to get most people, the majority of people, never lived long enough to get.
Oh, because disease, quality of life. Right. Just on
so
average,
100 years ago,
hard
average
life.
Lifespan was 47.
Wow.
Okay, which means that pretty much everybody in this room, except Yvette, is dead.
Wow.
Well done.
Right?
Wow.
Yeah.
You can't see her on camera,
people,
but she's right over
never
there.
Never got old enough.
The prettiest one in the room.
Largely.
Because
it is an acquired disease, right? Yeah. No one starts off with plaque.
Yeah.
It is 100% acquired disease, right?
It's like lots of factors. Because your arteries are like slip and slides.
Yeah.
Remember the slip and slide?
Yeah.
Before they outlawed it because all these old guys were breaking their backs.
And lawn darts.
And lawn darts, yeah. But it's like the slip and slide, right? Remember the slip and slide?
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's interesting that only until relatively recently was angina identified, named, and described in medical literature.
1812.
Wow.
Yeah, okay, because the reason why I was asking is I wasn't thinking, what an epiphany. I wasn't thinking about mortality rates being because we just didn't live as long because life was sucky back then. It was really hard, right?
Yeah,
we went to work when we were 11.
Tuberculosis, cholera, trauma,
inflammation,
malnutrition. Like just the flu, right?
Yeah. Right.
How many people did the Spanish flu kill?
Oh, I mean, million,
right? Yeah. So 60, crazy. So,
50, 60 million.
Yeah, the world was just out to get you. It's like living in Jurassic Park again, right? Everything was out to kill you.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So or Australia.
Yeah, fair enough. So aside from that, right? Aside from that, what I was thinking, where I was going with this was, is it also diet related, like lifestyle and diet related? So are more people having heart attacks and strokes nowadays at earlier years or earlier ages because of the foods we eat?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And we see a disparity, you know, I'm curious what you both think, a disparity between like U.S. versus, say, other countries that aren't so fat foodie. Is that even a word? Like, I don't know.
So
like,
a great example of that is Finland, okay?
Yeah.
So Finland, up until about 30 years ago or so, had some of the highest rates of heart disease in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
The Finnish?
Finland's. Yeah, the Finnish, right?
Okay.
And a lot of it was they ate an incredible amount of saturated fats and just nasty stuff, right?
Really?
So the Finnish people, to their credit, realized, this is not good. We're leading the world in something we do not want to lead the world in, which is heart disease.
Yeah.
So they started at a cultural, governmental, societal level and said, we need to change these things that we can change. Now, there's a lot of factors that are certainly genetic related to heart disease, but, you know, those are genes. But let's attack the environment.
The things we can't control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they, via, you know, getting people to, with a lot of governmental nudges and societal changes and food changes and all that, dramatically lowered the risk of cardiovascular events in Finland.
Where are they eating now? Do you know where they are now?
Oh, they're really on the low end of things.
Right? Okay. Which happened, what, in the 60s, 70s?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So the good news is that a lot of this, you know, there's lots of tools to treat heart disease, right? Diet, exercise, lifestyle, medications, et cetera. But, you know, just a good lifestyle, knocking out the smoking, right? Because there was a lot of smoking. Mm-hmm. Cleaning up the diet.
Processed foods.
Processed
foods, all
that.
Because they didn't have processed foods back in the 17, 1800s, right?
No.
Everything was grown locally.
Right.
Yeah. And it rotted if it was out too long.
It wasn't eaten.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, just the other day, I went to the refrigerator. I'm like, wait, this has been in the refrigerator for like 7 weeks. And I opened it up. I'm like, I could probably still eat this. I'm throwing this away. like there's no way I'm eating this now because it's probably full of something that's keeping it alive for so long, right? So we're living longer is what I'm hearing, docs, right?
Right.
We're living longer.
Which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing. Yep. But we're eating really crappy foods for the most part. Most of us are because we live fast lifestyles. We're picking up foods. Everything's processed. The stuff comes from all over the world. It's shipping in. Like how often do you live next to a farm where you're buying strawberries and meat? Right?
Right.
So it's preservatives, whatever. So we're living longer and we're eating worse. So the disease has a chance to really proliferate, progress. And that's what you guys think that why we're dying of heart attacks and strokes? Why it's the number one cause of death?
Peak in the U.S., peak cardiovascular death was in the 60s.
Ah.
Okay. From the 60s till the early 2000s, we really reduced it a lot, right?
Really?
So less smoking. Statins came into the scene. We better understood things like high blood pressure and better treatments for high blood pressure, et cetera. So there was a dramatic decline from peak heart disease in the 60s till the early 2000s, okay? Now, at the same time, overlying that was processed food and the food industry, mass food industry and all of those things. So, and the other thing is, as we quit smoking, right? We all gained weight.
Visceral fat.
Visceral fat.
Yeah.
So
and snacking at the middle of the night.
2000. Mm-hmm. So it went down and down and down every year consistently, which is remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, imagine if I'd said cancer death rates in roughly about 40 years fell by 60%. Well, yeah, we didn't do that. But they did fall for cardiovascular disease. Okay?
Got it.
However, 2011, they started going back up. Now, less smoking. But for now, we have an obesity epidemic, right? Which then causes diabetes, that visceral fat causes high blood pressure, cholesterol disorders, hypertension, all of those other nasty things, sleep apnea, DJD, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so we've been losing the battle since 2011 here in the U.S.
You know, that's so interesting. And I know this is your podcast, but just reel us in anytime you want because we could talk forever. But just to that point,
Yeah.
This is a personal reference, that a point that I have. And some of you who are watching your podcast, your listeners, your followers, may resonate with this. My wife is Mexican, and we've been married for 27 years. I met her 28 and a half years ago while I was in Mexico City. And I remember what it was like in the 1990s in Mexico. And it was very far and few between where I saw what I consider to be overweight men and women. Mainly women, because that's what I focused on back then before I met my wife. So I didn't see a lot of overweight women, okay?
Yeah.
And it was like, wow, this is unique, right? This is unique. Over the 27 years that I've been married, I have noticed, however, that Mexico has changed a lot. And now it's hard to find a woman that isn't overweight or a man that isn't overweight. I've seen it in my own in-laws. I've seen it in friends and family members that I've created over the years. It has been dynamic, and I've thought about that. You know, I'm one of those guys, like I'm sure you guys and a lot of your listeners are.
Mm-hmm.
You latch onto something, you want to know why. You go down that rabbit hole, and so I did my own little backdoor research kind of thing, and it turns out that I identified there was a point in time, right around 2011, 2010 time frame, when Mexico opened up broadly to fast food restaurants, to Americanization. Mm-hmm. It's the number one country in the world for consumption of Coca-Cola products.
Exactly.
They drink, if you've ever been to a quinceañera or a party, they have 10 2-liter bottles everywhere.
Right.
And it's sugar, tons of sugar, saturated fats. They've adopted, because it was the cool thing to do, the American lifestyle, and the American companies just flooded in. NAFTA, all that stuff that opened it up to free trade, whatever. Mm-hmm. It was our lifestyle that was affecting their lifestyle.
Yeah.
That's my own conclusion. I don't have any facts behind that other than what I've read and my own deductions, but yeah.
So I'll go be, okay. Number one per capita intake of Coca-Cola, Mexico.
Mexico.
Number one cause of death in Mexico is diabetes.
Diabetes, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. That's
which is related to everything that you guys are
doing. And then, of course, there's patients with diabetes die of cardiovascular disease. But, yeah.
Heart health.
Yeah, so number one cause of death in Mexico is diabetes.
No kidding. Right?
And that occurred in a generation.
Yeah, my brother-in-law has diabetes. He's in his 50s.
Yeah.
And he has diabetes, pretty severe, the feet. Yeah. Things and whatever, and we're trying to deal with that. But yeah, I mean, you know, and guess what he does? He throws big 80s parties full of 2-liter bottles of Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Right? I know it's a stretch, but anyway, sorry. Yeah. Back to you.
No. On that note, what I'd like to talk about a few things is, you know, obviously a lot of my listeners don't know about Clearly and all that sort of stuff, but the thing is, with it being actionable, and you just had a guy in here earlier where you'd done some things, and then, you know, part of the protocols that we work with are based on, you know, some of the papers you were an investigator on. But, you know, you just had the guy in here that had, you know, within a year's time.
Mark Cozart.
Yeah. Really a decrease in this plaque load, which, you know, you're looking at things and actually staging them based on plaque load, which you can see,
right?
You know, of course it diversifies it further, which is very helpful, but you know, for, you know, and based on that plaque load, you're rechecking it in 1, 2, or 3 years. But you know, for him, he had significant load and then you rechecked it. So kind of talk about that case, because I thought that was pretty cool. I was just eavesdropping.
Yeah, so the using AI to detect heart disease and quantify, which is really incredibly important, because you know, if you'd had, you know, you had someone who had known heart disease, like stents, balloons, bypass surgery, heart attack, strokes, whatever, right? Has known heart disease. And then, you know, you're gonna treat them with all the appropriate pillars of prevention, which is diet, exercise, non-pharmacologic things, medications, etc. What we could not answer until just a few years ago with the ability to identify and quantify very accurately plaque is you couldn't ask your doctor, well, after all my diet, exercise, weight loss, medications, et cetera, is my plaque better? Mm-hmm. You couldn't answer that. Now, if you had cancer, you'd get worked up. Hopefully, we'd detect it early. We would stage you. We would treat you. And then we'd restage you to know, is the cancer gone? Is it better? Is it worse? Right? Mm-hmm. That's just the typical modus operandi of cancer oncology care.
Right? Which is rationalized.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense, right? You'd want to know, okay, did the treatment that I did
work?
In the world of cardiology, couldn't even answer that. I could say, well, your cholesterol's better and blood pressure's better and your weight's better and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But I in no way could I answer, is my plaque better? What AI now allows us to do is detect plaque across an incredible spectrum, right? From we can also say, there is no plaque. End of stop, full stop, end of story, full stop, mm-hmm. boom.
With certainty.
With certainty, mm-hmm. right? Which only occurs in 1% of kind of the middle-aged population. Or we can say, yeah, you have some plaque. You have no symptoms. There's no blockages. Your stress test would be normal. There'd be no way to detect this, again, if you've heard this earlier, except if we did an autopsy. But mm-hmm. let's do the virtual autopsy as well. We call that cardiac CT with AI. Or we'll find, you know, and then, you know, depending upon how much plaque you have, we can put you in these different stages that do two things. One, we have stage 1, 2, and 3 for atherosclerosis stages. If you're 1, 2, or 3, that dictates both what we might recommend to do to treat it, which obviously, you know, stage 3, you kind of get the whole kitchen sink thrown at you, mm-hmm. as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And then it also dictates when we look under the hood again,
right.
to make sure not only are the numbers better and I'm weighing less and I'm not smoking and my cholesterol's better and blood pressure and all those check boxes, right? But we really want to know, are all of those surrogates translating into, is the plaque better?
Yeah.
And it's interesting. Most time, yes. But I've also run into people who have phenomenal numbers.
Yeah.
And they got more plaque.
I was going to ask you that. So, you know, have you had people that have like a really low ApoB and have significant disease and vice versa? I mean,
Right. No, I've had, I can give you examples. One is a doc that I've known for 25 years, had a high calcium score, got him as we did clearly and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was pretty well treated, but you know, we really ratcheted down. He had a lot of disease, right? Really ratcheted things down, got him all the right drugs, lost a lot of weight, you know, everything looked perfect. So I said, okay, let's take another look. Yeah. His plaque got worse.
Huh?
There's always tweaks we can do, but in his case, you know, so we added colchicine.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, lipids look good. Blood pressure looks good. He lost weight, but his CRP was still high.
Okay.
So we added colchicine. So there's always something we can do. But had we not done that, I would have gone, I don't know, and it looks good.
Mm-hmm.
And his plaque was progressing. Another guy.
Because he had this low-level inflammation going on.
Exactly, right?
And colchicine.
So we used an anti-inflammatory drug.
A cheap drug.
Yeah, cheap, right? Yeah. Well-tolerated. We've used it for decades.
Mm-hmm.
So cardiac CT and AI was really helpful in that case. And without the AI, I mean, I couldn't have looked at his images and go, they would have looked the same by my eye, right? Having done 20,000 of these over the last 25 years. But AI told me that he was progressing, and his lipid-rich soft plaque actually was going up.
Yeah.
I said, okay, what are the things when we throw at this? So we added on a drug that's been available for decades and safe and well-tolerated and cheap. So I'll let you know with his next scan what things look like, okay? But it provided very useful, actionable data.
Precision,
to say the numbers are the numbers, the surrogates are the surrogates, but is the plaque better? Mm-hmm. And I could not have done that without cardiac CT and
AI.
No
more guesswork, right? Short. Mm-hmm. Those days are over.
Exactly.
And then the opposite, right? A guy who, you know, works out 6 days a week, looks incredibly healthy, bad family history.
Yeah.
Lipids were really pretty unremarkable.
Mm-hmm.
No blood pressure issues, no diabetes, glycemic issues, no smoking. Anyway, we put him in the scanner, and this is really eye-opening to me. Again, a lesson that I learned, because I learn lessons every day.
Humbling.
It is very humbling, right? AI, CT and AI is very humbling. So we put him in the CT machine, and his coronaries look perfect. I've read 20,000 studies. I think I'm reasonably good. Coronaries look fine. We get the AI back.
Yeah.
His score was 400.
You're talking about 400 cubic millimeters.
Stage two.
Oh my gosh.
No blockages.
Yeah. Okay.
The AI lit up his vessels.
Yeah.
Right. I couldn't see it.
Sure.
Right. Very humbling, but that's okay. I'll use the technology
good,
I got to use.
You're still good.
400 and not a speck of calcium.
Oh, wow.
Because he'd had a calcium score before. And I said, I'm not going to trust it. So we did cardiac CT. Again, it looked fine. Yeah. But the AI, it was amazing. It was a light show with his AI when we did the AI. I mean, it just lit up. So with that in mind, we tweaked things. Put him back in the scanner because he's stage two, so he has 2 years to rectify his wayward ways.
Mm-hmm.
We did all the right, you know, fixed all that. Again, his lipids were normal, really. Didn't have any other factors, but fixed all that. Rescanned him 2 years later, 200. 50% reduction.
Excellent.
Yeah. Which also to me, now this is my hypothesis, it also suggests to me if you catch somebody really early on in that process,
mm-hmm.
the plaque is probably more malleable mm-hmm. versus I got a lot of plaque, I got lipid-rich plaque, calcified plaque, et cetera.
Right.
This is just hypothesis for everybody. But it is very interesting that N of one experience and to see such rapid change that maybe the earlier we catch it,
mm-hmm.
the more we can really have a big, big impact.
It responds faster in the earlier stages. Yeah, very interesting.
It's hypothesis, but it is intriguing. I mean, this is where science comes from.
Be an interesting study.
Make hypothesis, and then you study it.
I might fund something like that. Yeah. I'd be open to funding a study like
that. You know, as you talk about regression of plaque, I had a patient, big car guy. You always know when he's coming because you can hear whatever cool car he's driving is just will shake your soul.
I think I passed him on I-35.
V12 Hemi or something.
But they're
like
cool. They're
exist.
Cool. Oh, yeah, I mean, always very. But anyway,
no replacement for displacement.
So he asked me a question, and you can elaborate on this further. And I went back and being a lipidologist, as you talk about regression of the plaque, you know, it's like where does it go? And I knew, you know, there's receptors on the liver, it's excreted, et cetera. But if it's in an artery, it has to go through the capillary system, back to the venous system, back to the and all that. As it reabsorbs, what's the general? I mean, high level explanation of.
So, and again, if you quote me, date me, so, you know, this is what we believe right now, that, you know, you get the bad plaques, the lipid-rich plaques, the active lava plaques, right, are embedded in the vessel wall.
Mm-hmm.
When we really turn off the fertilizer, right, so your cholesterol is X, we lower it by 50, 60% lower than X, mm-hmm. right, there is no further infiltration of lipid from the blood into the plaque anymore. We have macrophages; they will start eating it up. Mm-hmm. But usually, that whole system is so overwhelmed by how much lipid is coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, your lipid levels aren't very helpful to understand if you have plaque or not, because you know it's very complex how much lipid is coming in, how much is being metabolized, eaten up by your macrophages, the garbage truck cells of the body.
Mm-hmm.
But if we really turn off the lipids, right, and there's usually blood pressure and glycemic issues and all that, that I won't get into. We'll keep it pure in the lipid space. If we really turn off that faucet, we now give the body the opportunity to basically metabolize that lipid. Mm-hmm. And so we do see, in fact, it's really fascinating, and this is really great news for everybody. On one level, it's sort of easy to understand that because it is a very slow glacial process, right, that when that occurs, yes, we can see reversal in an anatomic level, right? So, you know, the hole is bigger, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very, very slow process. That occurs months to years. AI will see that change long before we can even say it anatomically as far as the degree of narrowing. Okay, so AI is a early leading indicator, right? So we can reverse plaque in an anatomical structural way. However, the best news is, but that takes months to years. The best news is, and we had a lot of data even before we had the era of cardiac CT, and that if you look at events, right, which are ruptured plaques, when you begin to lower cholesterol, the reduction in events begins to occur within days to weeks. Well, that's long before we see any anatomical difference, right? This is also before AI.
Mm-hmm.
But that's long before you see enough plaque resolve, the vessel is bigger in an anatomical structural way. So what's occurring at the functional physiologic basis, right, mm-hmm. is that we're very, very quickly rendering those plaques, which are rupture prone or vulnerable plaques, when we target that plaque, diet, exercise, cholesterol, smoking, whatever might be appropriate, mm-hmm. Then we rapidly convert those plaques from active, growing, rupture-prone, vulnerable plaques into stable plaques, mm-hmm. and that occurs in days to weeks,
so
which is exciting.
Yeah,
it is. We don't have to wait or get through months to years because we're changing the physiology of plaque, not necessarily the anatomy, but the physiology of the plaque within days to weeks when we began to do all
which
these
things. Which is remarkable.
And which is fantastic, right? Which yeah. makes me feel great because yeah. I can yeah. say, hey. And now, the interesting thing is the contrafactual to this is, conversely, if you have plaque mm-hmm. and you stop the drugs, most of the data was with cholesterol drugs, but, you know, if you stop the drugs, the plaques rapidly wake up. So if you stop your cholesterol-lowering drugs,
yeah
they're going to rapidly convert from stable, quiescent plaques mm-hmm. to vulnerable plaques, and that, again, occurs in weeks.
So the big take-home there is, just because you have a lot of plaque, and say we do is, you know, your CT, and it's like, mm-hmm. oh, you're riddled with stuff, and they think, right. oh, crap, what can I do? Right. Well, you can make a difference within a week
Precisely.
By just tweaking some things.
And it's really important that you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Like Mark, who was sitting here earlier, yeah. Who you happen to be out there waiting to get mm-hmm. in to speak with us.
Yeah.
He was late stage 3. Mm-hmm. He had over 1,000 total plaque burden.
Yeah.
1,000 millimeters.
That's a
well,
lot.
And yes, you know, with the AI too, it gives you very yeah. accurate measurements of stenosis. Not mm-hmm. that I really worry about that because it's all about plaque. Right. But it's interesting, in 90 days, right, over that 90 days before he came to see me, he'd had at least one stress test, a nuclear stress test, right? You know, lots of radiation cost, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was perfectly fine, mm-hmm. right? Well, if you look at his cardiac CT, I didn't make this point out, but if you look at his cardiac CT and the narrowings, he had 3 vessels that were greater than 70%, and his stress test was completely normal.
And he had no symptoms.
And no symptoms.
88, I believe he had 88%, a 90%, and a 79%.
Yeah, exactly. How did he come to you guys in the first place?
He got lucky.
Yeah. I mean, he went through 3 other cardiologists before another one of my patients, they're also in aviation,
right.
talked to him and said, hey, I know this crazy doc. Yeah. Dr. Osborne,
he had 2 heart catheterizations.
Yeah.
So his story, real quick, was he went for a general checkup. He's a very active. He's a contractor, building contractor. He's in his 60s, but the guys, he's changing, running up ladders. Guy's in great shape. Mm-hmm. He just went for a general checkup. Mm-hmm. They did a stress test, EKG, whatever. They went, I don't know, something maybe, whatever, calcium, whatever. He ended up. Ended up going 2 heart catheterizations, 3 cardiologists, to the point where within 90 days of him having a general checkup, they wanted to do major open heart bypass surgery, and the testing of his arteries showed that his arteries were too narrow, and they were thinking about taking
cadaver veins.
And like, so immediately he started freaking out. He's thinking he's going to drop dead. They're sure. telling him he's going to die.
Sure.
To meeting with us, and now we're sitting on the couch with him a year later, and we've reduced his total plaque burden, soft plaque,
right, over 30%,
36.4%
in one year, and what's remarable is we got it. He also had he had 2 car casts, cardiac CT, so they used the right tools, at least one of them, not an angiogram, and so we got the cardiac CT that he had done before at the other hospital. Mm-hmm. We finally got that in our talons. And so then we could do the comparison from prior CT that was not done by me, but elsewhere. So we got that data. Did AI on that.
Sure.
Did AI on the one that we did. Mm-hmm. And we could see in just 1 year with just all the, you know, diet, exercise, weight loss, working with our nutritionists and stuff, over 30% reduction. You have the number.
36.4%
reduction in plaque.
Converting that.
And that's in the soft
calcium.
Plaque.
Yeah.
Right.
And in 1 year.
That's remarkable.
But importantly, what Dr. Osborne was saying earlier is we didn't have to wait for that whole year to reduce his risk of heart attack or stroke. Right. That happened with the days and weeks.
Yeah.
Right?
So I think that's really important.
It is.
That people get, you know, like some people, they come in and they don't know where to start, kind of thing. They get overwhelmed. And, you know, like if your office is completely trashed, where do I start to clean it up? Well, if you do something right then, it makes a difference right then.
Exactly. So, right. It's very immediate, which is great. And it's something I like to share with my patients, too, because it's kind of like saying, okay, well, you got cancer.
Yeah.
We'll give you treatment. It'll be a couple years long. We'll give you treatment. Now, if you do not die, within 2 years, the cancer will be better. But I don't know, in the next 2 years, God knows, right?
Yeah.
I mean, but imagine you say, okay, once you start the chemo, the cancer will be on the run. And that's really what we're doing with cardiovascular chemo, right? Your diet, exercise, whatever medications you use.
Yeah. Well, I think what you guys are doing is great. One more point I want to make is that, and it just happened fairly recently, you really can't tell by looking at somebody.
Gosh, no.
Have you been shocked? Like I've had, I have one guy.
So JD said, and I use this all the time, right? Cardiac CT and AI, unbelievably humbling, right? Yeah. You'd think, I've been doing this 30 years. I got good spidey sense. No, no. I want to hear your story.
No, I mean, yeah, this guy's in his 40s. He's a trainer. Just kind of fit and but lean. I mean, handsome man. Looking at him, you never know.
He was a month, a week older than you.
No, he wasn't that guy. But his lipids were high. He didn't want to do any intervention. This is before he started doing Clearly.
Because I feel fine.
And so, he wanted to do us some other things.
The mirror makes him look like $1 million.
Yeah, he was looking at all the noise from a cardiologist saying statins are bad and Medicaid, and all that kind of stuff. So he's getting some bad information. Yeah. But and some people, you just listen to him. You can't really. And
sure.
Anyway, he's had a bypass. He's doing great, but in his 40s.
So he had an event.
Yeah.
So he had a heart attack.
Great, great guy. I mean, I really love the guy, but kind of a rough deal. But he's doing great and
everybody think it's not me.
But my point is that it's so shocking that and somebody can look terrible and they have great.
My joke, Kevin, is I'll see, the big Texan.
Yeah.
Barely fits through the wall, the door rather, through the door, right?
Well, they could go through the wall.
And I just see him, right? And I like to say, belt at 45 degree angle.
Yeah.
Belly enters before the nose. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? And I'm going, five vessel bypass surgery. And I've had these guys, I'll say guys because I'll be sexist about that. but I've had those guys walk in. I'm going, five vessel bypass surgery, right? Spidey sense, nothing, right?
Yeah.
Clean as a whistle.
And then I've had the 33-year-old guy who had LP little A, familial hypercholesterolemia. Mm-hmm. It was all his mom's fault, as it turns out. Actually, got LP little A from dad and familial hypercholesterolemia from mom.
Oh, my.
So the guy flew for the Air Force, pilot, all that stuff, and actually went to the Air Force Academy. And so he was told by the flight surgeon when he was in his 20s, said, man, your cholesterol's high. Better eat right and exercise. Okay, the guy's a triathlete, Ironman. Nothing bad ever crossed his lips. No other risk factors for heart disease. Perfect blood pressure. Never smoked. Did everything you'd like.
Yeah.
And was ripped, right? Probably 7% body fat. He went to bypass surgery at age 33.
Oh,
now, here's the good news. That was 20 plus years ago.
Yeah.
He's never had another intervention since then, because by that point, his disease was so extensive, he needed mechanical fixes. But we got his cholesterol under control in a few weeks, and that was it.
So the new vessels aren't going to end up like the old vessels.
Exactly.
Because they can turn into the...
And then the next generation is he had me see his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's right.
Look who his dad
was. One of our patients.
Guess what? I mean, and she was 18, because I'm an adult cardiologist. She was 18, but she was still in high school. And obviously, perfectly healthy kid, but no one had looked at her lipids or put all this together. We checked her lipids. Yeah, looked just like dad's.
By the
time she was 18, she got started on drugs. Looks like, and then nothing will happen to her.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is great.
You know, that's a good point. Even if, somebody is, if they've already had intervention, stents, bypass, whatever, this tech is still very useful.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Oh my God, yes. You know, we can look at your graphs. Yeah. We can look at your stents. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody wants to know, are they okay? Which is fine. And, mm-hmm. and we will. And that's fine. I mean, you get all that data for free. Yeah. But really, it gets back to, I want to know where your plaque is, yeah. what your plaque volume is, you know, what your lipid-rich plaque is, your right. soft plaque. And you're going to get that. So now, I will say, for the audience, if you've had stents, you can get your Clearly. You can get to the AI. According to the FDA, it has not been FDA approved for bypasses. We call it CABGs, coronary artery bypass grafting, or bypasses. Mm-hmm. So if you've had bypass, they will reject the study, FYI. So that's...
It doesn't mean the study isn't accurate. It is.
Right. I mean, I think there's still value. I could look at it qualitatively. I could see lipid-rich plaques. And in the old days before AI, you know, I'd have studies. I'd look at the old one and the new one, and I'd say, okay, look, there's more calcium here. You know, there's less lipids. So you could do it in a qualitative sense. But I'm so spoiled with AI that, you know, that's the old days.
Sure.
But if you've had bypass right now because of FDA clearance, the AI company will kick that out, unfortunately. But cardiac CT is still very, very useful. You can look at all the graphs, mm-hmm. and you can look at the natives, and you can see lipids and stuff. But you can't apply, unfortunately, and this is just an FDA clearance hickey for the time being. That'll be fixed in the future. You can't apply the AI to that just because it's not cleared.
But for stents and
But for stents, yeah, all day, every day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, no matter where you are, either prevention, you've never had issues, or you're already on the other side of the heart attack or stents, or again, bypass surgery, cardiac CT is phenomenal.
Yeah.
If you've had cardiac CT for the moment, can't do it. But with stents, we absolutely can do AI and then measure exactly how much plaque you have, lipid, and then, you know, use that to follow that.
In fact, I would say anybody who has stents, I would highly recommend it because
there's probably more. Oh, yeah.
There's more reason to come in because you know for sure.
Because not only did you have plaque, but you had plaque that ruptured tried to kill you.
That's right. Exactly. Right? So come on in and let us, because again, stents only resolve the symptom. Mm-hmm. It's not addressing the root underlying cause of the disease, which is the liquid plaque. And so lipid plaque. So
I would say the only people I wouldn't recommend cardiac CT and AI on, you don't have a pulse and you're not breathing. Now, you can get beautiful CT images if you don't have a pulse.
Yeah.
Oh, there's no motion. Don't have to pre-medicate them.
Yeah.
But, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
But other than that, I think anyone.
Do you see that the future of cardiovascular screening, that this will eventually be something
this is
that they
be
do
the
every
cardiac
5 years or 10 years or whatever?
I mean, everything's here. Mm-hmm. The hardware, the software, the understanding, the biology, the literature. But as you know, medicine changes very, very slowly, right? I still remember, you know, as a resident in internal medicine, we were talking about, you know, doing stool guaiacs combined with a left-sided sigmoidoscopy, right? And is that, how does that compare to cold? I mean, just crazy stuff. No, you don't do any of that stuff. You just put a scope up there.
Yeah,
done,
in fact,
right?
This is an interesting for your viewers. In 2009, Texas was the first state in the United States, in the entire union, to pass a law. A bill was passed in the House and the Senate here in Texas that was the very first heart attack prevention law that required private health insurance, not Medicare, Medicaid, Medicare Plus, but private healthcare insurance companies in the state of Texas to cover all Texans for a minimum testing in order to prevent heart attacks and strokes. At the time, it was calcium score because that was state of the art. It was like, if you have a calcium score, then you probably blah, blah, blah. You know, we all know that now is not, it doesn't matter, you know, so much anymore. But it was all they had at the time. And they covered, like, I think it was $200 or something like that was the average.
Yeah, they pay $100 for your calcium score.
Yeah, $100 for your calcium
15 years ago.
And they were required to do it. That was a long time ago. Right now, Clear Cardio, along with Clearly, and Jim Min, who's their CEO and chairman of the company, one of the co-founders, is and I are working with Senator Angela Paxton. So Senator, and she's the wife of Attorney General Ken Paxton. She's a Texas senator, And she's driving the bill that we worked together with her on to amend that law because it's been, you know, how many years? 16 years-ish. Yeah. So to include CT and AI analysis as part of that and increase that coverage amount to to cover a portion of it or if not all of it. And because that is the standard now and because we know definitively it works.
And as much as we tend to evolve very, very slowly in medicine, very, very conservative. I have to tell you, and we just found this out last week, I am incredibly excited to note that of those that are supporting this, we have the Texas chapter of the American College of Cardiology, which is huge because, you know, we have lots of my interventional colleagues in there. But, you know, those that understand this go, hey, this is very important.
We're all working together.
And we'll find stuff that people didn't know about and they'll be taken care of. But the other thing is, just as big, if not even bigger, is the Texas Medical Association, which is huge. I mean, it's 56,000 physicians in Texas, and they're behind this as well, which is really, I think it's, you know, we're crossing our fingers.
We're very optimistic that this is going to happen, and so we've got a number of our existing patients.
Texas is leading the way, which is phenomenal.
Well, you think about the dollars it's going to save.
Oh, gosh.
Billions.
$20,000 heart casts, several $1,000 nuclear stress tests, all that kind of stuff.
I'm a resident, and you get
the answer, right? Yeah. It's not, did an EKG, and now you do a stress test a few weeks later, and that looks funky, and then a few weeks after that, a heart cath, and all the during the time you think you're going to die. And just the delay, the time, the cost. I mean, one tool, done, that's it. It's binary. If you got a problem, we'll see it. If you don't, you don't.
And I'm from Boston, you know, but I'm very pleased to say that I'm a Texas implant now, and I love Texas and so many reasons.
You've been grafted.
Yes, I've been grafted. That's a cardiovascular joke, by the way. So to see that Texas led the way back then, and now we're upgrading that to be today's version of that and leading the way again. And I think you're going to see the dominoes fall in the rest of the country when they see the value that their proposition.
Even 2009, calcium scoring, no one had heard of this, right? I mean, I'd been doing it for over 10 years by that point, but no one had heard of this. And so it was a big, big deal to advocate and talk about calcium scoring and doing it and paying for it, right? Now, in 2025, guess what? Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, I mean, it's still underutilized, but, and again, it's not perfect. You can miss stuff and all that, but, you know, it's better than no cardiovascular imaging. But, you know, now a lot of people are beginning to start doing calcium scoring, right? Yeah, that's much more notable.
Yeah.
So we're kind of where we were with cardiac CT and AI, where we were 15 years ago with calcium scoring.
Right.
But we're hoping to turn that around and really advance this so that we don't have more useless deaths for a disease that is detectable decades before you get in trouble. And we have incredible arrays, as you well know, of tools to treat and stop and reverse plaque.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the early detection.
And we need the cardiac colonoscopy. RFK just the other day, 2 days ago, you sent me the article, was very audible about how important this type of imaging is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think it's changing. And, you know, we're going to go after Texas first and then next the nation.
Yeah.
Well, that's a big state.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah,
it's no small feat.
Ninth largest economy in the world.
Yeah.
Well, man, thanks for letting me hang out with you guys.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, no,
thanks for having
pleasure.
Us on your podcast.
Thanks for letting me use your wonderful place. And do you guys have anything else you want to say, JD?
No, just you know, we did an earlier podcast with you on our power, prevention is power podcast.
Yeah.
And so thank you for participating.
Sure.
We are very grateful for fellow. Preventionists, I guess we call ourselves, who are out there trying to save people's lives every day. So thank you for what you're doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're going to send everybody who's in the Oklahoma City area to your place to
absolutely.
Get all the things that you, the benefits that you provide.
Yeah.
Thanks. And it's great to meet fellow travelers, right? And one of my favorite quotes from Ben Franklin, he says, "We all must hang together, otherwise we'll all hang separately." So here's to hanging together.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you guys. And thanks everyone for listening. And until next time, see you.